Kill stuff because you can.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, your Subcommittee on General Government. Today is February 22nd, 2016. We are going to have a very, very busy agenda. We've got 1 hour and 20 minutes to get through it, and I intend to get through the whole agenda. As you look at what's going to occur today, we're going to go into a work session on House Bill 4135. The public hearing and work session for Senate Bill 1596 has been taken off the agenda. It's going to be dealt with in the Capital Construction Subcommittee. We're then going to go into a work session on the Treasurer of State Investment Division Report. We're going to go into a work session on local government intermediate term investment pool. And then we're going to do a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 4131A. So with that said, I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 4135. Paul, what do we need to know?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 4135 is relating to fulfilling public record requests for electronic records. It requires the Department of Administrative Services to coordinate efforts of fulfilling public record requests for records in electronics form that DAS has custody of, and to help executive branch agency fulfill public record requests. The bill also requires DAS to coordinate requests when multiple executive department agencies receive requests. DAS anticipates needing two limited duration positions for this biennium to carry out the work. We worked with the department to determine that their existing limitation and revenue can pay for the work, but they'll need position authority, which will be established in the budget reconciliation bill during the 2016 legislative session.
Thank you. Gina, did you want to share anything on this bill? Are you good? I think we're good. So, Senator Johnson?
I guess I have a question. I've read the bill, and I understand why we're trying to do it. Frankly, I don't really see the reason we need the bill. One would think that this would be just a regular function of the state of Oregon responding to citizen requests for public records, and I know some of them are onerous, and I know some of them come from the press, and I know some of them are designed for purposes other than the complete revelation of the record. But I don't understand why we need the bill. The other thing is that if there are other things in place, I'm going to use the word artifice, in place to obfuscate the delivery of public information, how does the bill do any good? I'm thinking about agencies hiding behind attorney-client privilege. And I understand attorney-client privilege. I'm trained as a lawyer. I get that. But I think in some cases it's been grotesquely overused. And if the goal here is to create a pathway to respond to public records, it's going to be less a bill than it is the mindset of agencies to respond forthrightly. And maybe there's something that I'm missing, and we missed the chance to talk this morning, but I'd welcome understanding why it is that this is not just de rigor.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick. I'm a senior policy advisor to Governor Kate Brown. Yes, thank you for your questions, and let me see if the way I talk about this bill is sort of more in terms of a real-world example, and so maybe that will help some understanding of what our intent with the bill is to do. As you know, when the Governor Brown took office, she came in to office under many and heavy public records requests. Some of these requests went to multiple agencies. And one thing we realized, in addition to the need for additional legal help in determining what records are releasable, et cetera, that we realized that what would have been really useful was a technology expert, someone before you even get to analyzing the record, making sure. So the bill only applies to electronic records. And I think that's important because this is not a lawyer position. This is a tech position that would sit in DAS and help coordinate, especially when there's big records requests that go to multiple agencies. So, for example, if you have with records requests for the former administration, one agency might search Hayes and Kitzhaber. Another agency might search Kitzhaber and Hayes. Both are completely legal, lawful, responsive searches. And what we've discovered is that those actually can produce different bodies of work. And so this position is within DAS to help DAS agencies that have the same electronic mail system as DAS, and then to also coordinate with all the other agencies that do have different electronic systems to make sure that what we're starting with is a true and accurate portrait, like a true and accurate body that is responsive to the records request. So it's not another layer. It's basically a technology expert to help make sure agencies are actually and fully responding.
If I may respond. There are 90 of us in the legislative branch, as you know, and we're subject to public records requests all the time. I have found that our legislative media, not media, but the legislative technology folks, Bud Shop, does a remarkable job of helping us sort through those. Are we starting with a blank piece of paper here, or are there not lessons that could be gleaned from how the legislature responds, in some cases to legitimate records requests, in some cases to harassing records requests that are so voluminous? The other question that I have is with respect to this bill, this is the positions. Is the funding going to come from Department of Administrative Services or out of the governor's budget? I couldn't quite figure that out, and I see the lifeline from DAS appearing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the funding is coming from the DAS budget within their existing revenues and expenditure limitations. So we're not increasing expenditure limitation or increasing their revenues. We looked at their balances and found next biennium they're going to come. They're limited duration because they asked for temporary positions till they could fully develop a program for the 17-19 biennium, and they'll bring a pop forward in 17-19 budget for continuing the positions.
I appreciate your very precise answer, but it causes me to ask another question, and that is if we're using these two LDs to develop the protocol, why is there an ongoing cost biennium to biennium?
Mr. Chair?
Sure. Madam Co-Chair.
Did I understand you correctly to say that the whole intent is to develop a system and a way to run that from within DAS so that when there are records requests, we're sure that we're actually meeting them? And that's why it would be an ongoing. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I just want to make sure. I mean, and you can answer however you want, but I just wanted to. I'm confused now, too.
Commissioner Smith, members of the committee, Senator Johnson. For the record, Barry Pack with the Department of Administrative Services. We've asked for these to be limited duration positions because there are two bodies of work really required in the bill. It's the establishment of protocols and policies and procedures that are consistent and standard across all agencies for fulfilling of records requests for which there are electronic records that are responsive. The ongoing body of work and what will happen in the governor's budget in the future is how that gets housed and treated will be in a package there. But the ongoing work is the ongoing technical assistance to agencies who are receiving these requests or when there are the same request of multiple agencies. So as Gina referenced, the order in which you search in a Boolean logical search query matters, and if the same agencies are getting the same requests but running the queries differently, we can't be with full confidence sure that we are at least providing consistent access to records across multiple agencies. And we're really, these positions are someone who can help translate from the requester what the information they're really looking for, work with the agency business to figure out where those records might live, and then work with the technology people to figure out how best to produce them.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I don't know what this bill does either, but I don't think it does any harm. But what I would point out is that perhaps you do need an attorney to read the current statutes, because we're receiving testimony that a summary or condensation of a legal opinion would be a breach of attorney-client privilege. And if you look at 192.423, it says that you may, it's just voluntary, it doesn't say you have to, but it says that if you do choose to provide the people of the organ with what your idea, you know, with a condensation or summary of that legal advice is, it is not a waiver of attorney-client privilege. It couldn't be more clear. And yet we hear testimony that it is. So, I mean, perhaps reviewing the statute would be a good thing to do.
Those two can leave.
All right. Any more questions? Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4135 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 4135 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions? Any comments? Is there any opposition to the motion before us? See none, so passed. Madam Co-Chair, will you carry this to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means?
Yes, sir.
And then do we need to do the floors as well? We occur it to the Senate floor?
Yeah, unless there's somebody on my side who wants it. I mean, I don't know. We'll regroup if need be. Yeah, I'm fine.
Representative Nathanson, would you feel comfortable carrying this to the floor? Do you want me to carry it?
Yes, that's fine.
You're okay?
Is there... For now, I just want to check to see if there's someone else. I'm fine,
okay.
But I want to see if there's someone else who
right.
was counting on it.
Okay, so for now, Representative Nathanson will be the carrier on the House side, and it's at the request of the governor.
Yes.
So I think
yes.
we're good.
Yes.
Okay. All righty. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 4135. We are going to open up a work session on the Treasurer of the State Investment Division report. John.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. Budget note in House Bill 5041 from last session directed the State Treasurer to report as follows. The State Treasurer is to report to the legislature in 2016 on the hiring of newly authorized positions and the associated improvements to risk management, compliance, and investment decision support systems, investment analysis, data security, management reporting, internal controls, segregation of duties, issues, internal auditing, and the updating of policy and procedures.
All righty. Mr. Treasurer,
thank
welcome.
You.
It's good having you here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, thank you for the record. My name is Ted Wheeler. I'm Treasurer for the state. I want to thank you for your continued interest in what's going on at the State Treasury. I want to thank my team for their diligent work on two important projects that you're going to hear about today. The first is around improvements for the investment division. The second is the establishment of intermediate term pool fund for local governments. As I finish out my term as State Treasurer, I want you to know that these are two of my very top priorities. I also want to thank members of this committee for meeting with me and meeting with members of my staff and for your interest in the work that we do in the Treasury. In the Treasury, as you know, we manage about $90 billion of state investments. As you've heard me mention many times during my term as Treasurer, we have to ensure that we're properly resourcing this function and providing our investment division with the tools and the resources they need to do this critically important job. In 2015, the legislature granted our request for 23 new positions in the Treasury, which would directly address deficiencies that both we in Treasury and experts on the outside had identified within our organization. An additional position was granted during the December 2014 e-board. Of the 24 positions that you've authorized, 15 have now been filled. One will be filled shortly. 8 remain vacant. The hiring of those remaining positions will be done by some of our new key hires that are in leadership positions. We think it makes sense for them to hire the people that they will be managing. We're on track to complete our hiring as scheduled, and in fact, we're in the process of determining whether or not we should start our next round of hiring, which would actually put us ahead of the hiring schedule that we'd outlined. This is a very important and exciting time in the State Treasury as we're building out our program not only to address what we identified as deficiencies, but over the next several years, we're going to be building out an investment division that we think will best be able to handle the changing risks and dynamics of the markets to help us all meet our financial demands. You're going to hear first from our Chief Investment Officer, John Sherman, and you're going to meet for the first time our newly hired Director of Investment Operations, David Randall, who are going to update you on what we've been doing. I want to point out that David is just one of the new impressive hires we've made in the last few months. He comes to us from a private sector investment company right here in Oregon. After that, you're going to hear from our Deputy Treasurer, Darren Bond, and Policy Director, Kristen Dennis, who's sitting to my right, who will update you on the progress on the local government intermediate pool. We believe that this fund is going to be a tremendous asset, both to local governments and the state at large. My team has put a tremendous amount of work into taking inventory of our internal capabilities, developing a program based on feedback from local government, private sector investment firms, and other states who have similar programs. We are in negotiations with State Street Bank to handle the components necessary to make this program work. We've worked hard to ensure that local governments, their constituents, and the state are all getting the best option possible. And I want to be clear, we don't take this work lightly. As you know, the intermediate term pool, as we've discussed, has inherent risks. It is possible for participants in this pool to lose money, and we want to make sure that we got the program right. I look forward to advocating for the investment policies in my capacity as a member of the OIC on March 9th, and I'll leave it to Kristen and Darren at the end of this to explain the details of the local government intermediate term pool program and how we got to where we are today.
Perfect.
Thank you. And I will be in the room in
Perfect.
Case
anyone has
questions.
We're glad you're here. We have a question.
I have a question for the Treasurer.
Yes,
Senator Whitsitt.
In the LFO report here, the final statement in is that Oregon State Treasury report reflects that little progress has been made since the agency's November report. In your letter, it says critical for the success of the program is properly identifying local government needs within an intermediate pool. We will need a more accurate estimate of the immediate levels of participation. That bill establishing this directive was 34 months ago with an emergency clause on it. So I guess my question, I was assured in my office by your staff that this would be up and running no later than June. Can you make that assurance to us?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, Kristen Dennis, for the record. That is our best estimate. I cannot speak for the Oregon Investment Council, who would need to approve the investment policy for us to be able to move forward with contracting. We're still in final contract negotiations. We will detail all of this on our presentation when Mr. Bond and myself are up in front of you in just a little bit. So to the best of our knowledge, this is what we strongly believe will occur. We think it'll be early June that we'll be able to have this up and running, but I can't guarantee that. There are too many factors that could change that.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you.
Thank you.
So, colleagues, we have two different items before us. First, we're going to hear about the investment division report. And so, John and David, if you want to come up. And then we're going to hear about the local government intermediate term investment pool report. So, gentlemen, I'm going to give a total of 15 minutes on this so I can keep to my agenda here. So if you folks could give us an overview, and colleagues, feel free to ask questions as we go through the next 15 minutes.
Sure. Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner, Hayward, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Shervam, Investment Division Director at the Oregon State Treasury. Per the directions, we will go quickly. We have six slides. We'll hit the high points, but we hope you'll interrupt along the way with any questions.
Okay.
So we're going to start off with just a reminder of why we're here and how we got here. And we got here in a good way. We got here through many years of investment success. So the program was very successful long before I arrived. That success compounded, and it compounded at a pace that exceeded the staffing and the operational infrastructure. The success manifested in an increasingly large portfolio, increasingly complex. To the point where, when I arrived, we were really had the investment equivalent of running a modern day call center with rotary dial telephones. So we to affirm that, we had numerous outside studies, Cutter, Deloitte, Wilshire. We had a number of people look to see if things were as strained as we felt they were, and they did confirm through their research and peer group comparisons that we had reached the point where we could really put that success in jeopardy were it not for new investments in personnel and the infrastructure to support the program. And so at that point, the cavalry arrived. It arrived in two waves. The first wave was August of 2014, when the Oregon Investment Council gave us the authority to contract with BlackRock Solutions for an extensive series of tools and services that essentially modernized our investment platform. The second wave of the cavalry arrived last summer when the legislature approved our request for a spending limitation increase. With that, in the investment department, we got 16 additional posts. And so those two elements have got us off to a great start in rectifying the deficiencies that were identified. And just to remind you, those deficiencies were in three primary areas. Operating, again, we were operating a very large, very complex portfolio with tools and processes that were quite antiquated. The other area was investments, just the investment risks that in an era where GPS is increasingly common in the utilization and investment work, we were still operating through celestial navigation. And then finally, compliance. We had a very long and proud tradition of Lewis and Clark bootstrap pioneers doing a little bit of everything. But in a modern investment operation, doing a little bit of everything introduces compliance risks. So segregation of duties, specialization of labor is the most effective remedy to those types of compliance risks. So, again, Cavalier arrived in two waves, the BlackRock Aladdin platform and then the additional resources. And so we're here today with, given that background, we're here today to report the status. And I'm very pleased to report that in terms of our, let's see where we're on the slides. We're good. I'm pleased to report that in terms of the BlackRock Aladdin contract, we started implementation of that operating platform in the middle of March. And we had ambitious goals of a six-month implementation. And we activated the Aladdin platform on the subsequent 27th Monday, so we were on time. We were also on budget. We now operate, we are now running over $20 billion of internally managed state investment funds on the Aladdin platform. I'm going to turn to our new director of operations, and he can describe for you some of the operating benefits that Aladdin gives us relative to the processes we had in place before we had it.
As you're doing that, sometime in the next 12 minutes, are you going to talk about the positions that have been hired and the vacancies that still remain?
Yes. I'm going to go through that after Dave.
Perfect. Thank you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, Dave Randall, Director of Investment Operations for the Investment Division at Treasury. And to your request to maintain the time of the agenda, I'll walk through these relatively quickly. So just a few key points related to compliance and John hit on as well. Aladdin provides us the automated controls to use defined rules as a prerequisite for placing trades. So what this does is it allows an end-to-end compliance process both pre- and post-trade. The ability to monitor these types of compliance items allows a much more proactive approach throughout the process. In terms of the operational infrastructure, we've retired disparate systems and replaced them with the centralized, fully integrated platform. And the issue of manual process, user-based process, individual spreadsheets has also been replaced with standardization, workflow, and automation using an industry standard platform that's built on best practices. And I would say lastly, of critical importance, the investment program is dependent on data integrity in order to provide informed decision-making when it comes to investments. Whereas data previously was unreliable, often out of date, we now have an integrated real-time platform with live data valuations to allow for attribution analysis and portfolio management. Additionally, we have now a dedicated data integrity analyst to help ensure the accuracy of this data.
Okay, Chair Smith, for your previous question, this is the org chart of the investment division. circa summer 2014. And what's important to note is that was the same org chart that presided over many years of growth, many years of earned, accrued, and compounded value, maybe tens of billions of dollars of earned, accrued, and compounded value. And yet it was a skinny staff working hard, doing good work, but we had reached the point, as identified by many studies, that we needed to staff up to meet the increasing size and complexity of our portfolio. And again, with the additional resources that we got from the legislature last session, we have this new org chart to share with you. The upshot is, from last year's biennium, the investment division received approval for 16 new positions. We have hired 9 of those, including 3 senior positions. One of which sits right next to me. Those 3 senior positions were all subject to national searches. Happily, 2 of them came from our backyard.
24.
So 16 new positions. We've hired 9. We will make an offer on a 10th this week. And also this week we are going to market for 2 more. So by the end of this week we will have fulfilled 10 positions and be recruiting for 2 more. I would say the 4 remaining are at the discretion of Dave and his colleague Carl, and that's per my direction to them, that I wanted them to have a few months in the saddle before they decided and what they wanted, and I really wanted them to carefully calibrate what they needed before they went out on those searches.
Really quick, can you make a note to get us an explanation? There's a discrepancy. I'm looking at our report from LFO, and it's talking about that in 2015 we funded 24 positions or 21.6 FTE, and you're talking about 16.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
What did we do with the 8?
Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. John, speaking about the positions that are directly sitting in the investment division, if you remember, you also funded support positions relative to this. We had a data steward position.
We had IT positions,
et cetera, that are not in John's immediate chain of command. That's the difference.
Answers my question. Let's continue.
You should have been more thoughtful on that. Sorry about that.
Rep. Comp.
I'm going to thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm going to ask a very audacious question because this is my last year in this body, so I'm being obnoxious. We have now funded, and I looked at your deficiencies and people to take care of all these things. And so, but the bottom line, as we come into another budget cycle next year that is not going to be pretty, are we making more money?
Chair Smith, Representative Comp, we earned 2.1% total return in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
In nominal terms, that was not particularly impressive. In relative terms, it put us in the 11th percentile nationally. In the Cowan universe, it put us exactly number 1 in the Wilshire Tux universe. So our relative performance last year was outstanding. And that's a 5-year number. That's not a single. The 2.1 is what we earned in 2015. But that 2015 performance put us in the first percentile for the 5-year look-back period in the Wilshire Tux universe. So the thing to keep in mind is that the investment staff and the Oregon Investment Council, we are returns takers. We are not returns makers. The returns makers are people like Barack Obama, Janet Yellen, Paul Ryan, anybody in a policy position that has impact on macroeconomic policy ultimately dictates the returns that the market offers. we are returns takers. We can add value around the margins through our strategy and manager selections. We can add value around the margins through our risk management processes. But we are playing a relative game.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate your definition and what you're saying, because anybody, well, it's probably sitting on this committee, understands we are playing a game, but it's a game that affects our entire state, and I thank you for your work.
Sure. Thank you.
So we have 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Any other questions about the org chart? Okay.
Are you having any trouble with recruitment?
No.
Have you had any trouble with recruitment? Is it working pretty smooth?
The trouble is deciding which among many great qualified candidates to pick.
Good.
We are extremely blessed in this regard. We have a terrific, the Oregon Investment Council, the Oregon State Treasury has a terrific investment brand. And that's just not locally, that's nationally, that's internationally. We are in down to two finalists for the senior analyst position. We had 67 applicants.
Wow.
I would say that even the top 10 of them, if I had room, I would probably hire most of the top 10, let alone the finalists. So we are really in the catbird seat when it comes to recruiting.
Wonderful.
Last thing I wanted to share with you is where we go from here. So again, we did describe the fact that we implemented the Aladdin operating system on time and on budget. It now helps us manage about $21 billion of our $87 billion. So roughly 25% of the investment program is now managed internally on Aladdin. Where do we go from here? We've got this very contemporary, very sophisticated piece of investment and operating hardware. We're learning how to use it. Already with what we've got, but it's got a lot of capabilities, and so we're going to learn more, particularly on the risk management side. So the risk management, the application of risk management to public market securities, stocks and bonds, pretty straightforward. One of the reasons BlackRock was so anxious to partner with the Oregon Investment Council and the Oregon State Treasury in the installation and activation of Aladdin is because we have a very large, very mature, very complex private market portfolio. So they are going to learn from us just as much as we're going to learn from them, because the application of some of these sophisticated risk management techniques to private market portfolios is a relatively new frontier.
So is Aladdin, is that a cloud-based software program? Or?
Well, it's hosted... It's hosted at BlackRock.
Okay.
I don't know where they hosted the cloud. You know, it's not hosted in
Treasury.
They
handle all the maintenance and upkeep on the system?
They do. They do. An important part of our contract is they handle all the maintenance. Okay. But also, I think one of the things that we did really right is we bought it, or we contracted for it right off the shelf. In my previous organization, saw an Aladdin implementation go way over time and way over budget because of the client's insistence on customizing certain features. We have made no such demands, and so we've got something off the shelf that suits us just fine and therefore minimizes our need to do maintenance and upkeep and customization.
Security on the software?
It's all at BlackRock.
Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you. Just a quick question. We have heard repeatedly over the years that hiring was difficult due to compensation constraints. Now we hear that we have a great deal of a plentiful pool. So what changed?
Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, I'm not sure what has changed, because in my tenure, which is going on 3.5 years, the biggest impediment has been availability of positions. So we are in the public sector. None of us show up to get rich. We show up because we have a terrific mission. We have a terrific organization, and it's a great place to live. Those three things I have found to be powerful in terms of recruiting. It may be the case that before my tenure, compensation was an issue. It hasn't been since I've arrived.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, if I might. You'll recall that when we were in here with this package of asks last time, we had this exact discussion right here where you were questioning us on whether or not we were adequately, you know, whether we created these new positions at an adequate level of compensation to be able to recruit like we had hoped we would and like, as it turned out, that we have. Mm-hmm. And I assured you that we had went out to the market, we had assessed what we needed to pay, recognizing that we're in Oregon and this is a great place to live, and we were right. So we set these at reasonable compensation levels that are supported in the market and that reflect the quality of life here in Oregon, and we've been able to hire the people that we did. We've been fortunate to be able to find some people right here to fill some of these positions, and we've also went out and had attracted people from outside that have come in, and we have been really, really had the benefit of being able to look at some really outstanding people for these positions. We're really excited about who we've brought on.
Perfect. Thank you. And we're going to let that be the closing comment. Any further questions or comments? John, what do we need to be thinking about here?
LFO just recommends acknowledging receipt of the agency's report.
Senator Johnson, would you give me a motion?
I move the LFO recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Johnson moves the recommendation that we acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any questions on that, colleagues? Any concerns? Seeing none, so acknowledged. Do we need to carry that to full?
Yes, you do.
Senator Whitsitt, do you feel comfortable? Senator Whitsitt will carry this to full. All righty, so we're going to close the work session on the Investment Division Report. We're going to open up the work session. We're good. On the Local Government Intermediate Term Investment Pool Report. And colleagues, 15 minutes, and I'm going to hold real tight to this because I've got a public hearing I have to run right afterwards.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name, again, for the record, is Kristen Dennis. And
for the record, I'm Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer.
So we'll go ahead and get right into this. So the status on our Oregon Local Government Intermediate Fund, we've played with the name a little bit. We're in final contract negotiations with State Street Bank. We are on the agenda, the Oregon Investment Council's agenda for March 9th, 2016 for approval of our investment guidelines. We expect the fund to open approximately 90 days after that. As you know, the Oregon Investment Council approves investment policies for the state of Oregon. The fund description, the fund will be a commingled intermediate term investment pool. That means 1 to 5 years. So participants are expected to leave their money in for that duration. It will be actively managed to maintain a diversified portfolio of investment-grade quality fixed income investments. The portfolio is designed to achieve a total return, so again, that's principal and income, greater than the Barclays 1 to 5 year corporate government index. And please stop me at any point. Expected returns. So based upon historical market performance, we anticipate higher returns over extended periods than investments in shorter maturity alternatives. The fund is not structured to provide 100% net asset value on each participant's initial investment. The investments will fluctuate daily. So again, this is a riskier investment, and a participant should be looking to put their money in for a longer amount of time. You can lose money, but overall, we're hoping that over a longer period of time, they'll see greater increases. The value of each participant's investment is determined on a proportional basis to the net market value of the entire portfolio. So this is different than what local governments experience in the LGIP. There's no distribution of income or capital gains. Participants can share, participants sell shares.
Mr. Chair, I know you're trying to move quickly, but I want to go back to value of each participant's investment determined on proportional basis. Does that take into account that I'm just trying to understand how this works. The quality of the investments are decided by State Street Bank, not decided by the individual participants, are they not?
Correct.
Okay. All right, well, then maybe that does make sense. I just wanted to make sure that you were not managing to the lowest common denominator, which might be some not great investment Okay, I'm good.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, that's absolutely correct. Participants can buy into the portfolio. There's one option. We're not going to be managing if they want to, you know, have a more diverse or a different type of portfolio. It's straightforward.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Let's see. So because people are interested in returns, what I did is I took the our returns that Treasury has experienced for year-to-date to 5 years. So if you look here at the Oregon Short-Term Fund, over the five-year period, local governments participating in LGIP saw returns of 0.69%. Now, you compare this to the Oregon Intermediate-Term Pool. Now, they will not be structured exactly the same. We anticipate that the fund or the investment guidelines for the fund will be a little bit more conservative, but we anticipate that it will be very close to these returns. So over 5 years, you see 2.63% increase. But I want to note, too, that in year-to-date, if you're looking at just 2015, there wasn't much of a difference. Mm-hmm. So really, it's you want to put your money in this for longer. Eligibility. Participants must have an investment policy reviewed by the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board. The local government intermediate term fund must be listed as an eligible investment in the local government's investment policy. Governing body must acknowledge the following in a resolution recorded in meeting minutes. Investments in the fund are subject to loss. Investments withdrawal are subject to restriction by OST, the Oregon State Treasury, and they have read and understood the fund prospectus. This is just to make sure that we're above board and everybody understands what they're participating in. And additionally, sure.
Failure to comply with any of those disallows participation, I presume.
Correct.
Okay,
that's correct. And then a minimum balance, which we have not set yet, but we will identify a minimum balance.
What do you anticipate that will be? Just ballpark.
And so my guess would be, and Darren can correct me if I'm wrong, but sorry, Coach Smith, I would say at least $1 million is kind of what number we've been looking at.
Perfect. Thank you.
It might be a little bit more.
I would guess it might be bigger than that, but it'll be somewhere in that range.
Senator Johnson.
What proportion of possible investors fall below the line of that $1 million minimum balance?
Coach Smith, Senator Johnson, you'll remember back in the fall, we and some of the other, the League of Oregon Cities conducted surveys. A lot of participants expressed interest over that $1 million threshold. So we believe that there's a lot of local governments that are looking at that.
Begging your pardon, that did not answer my question.
So I have the League of Oregon City survey here. I'll share this with you really quick. Under $1 million. 23%, 19 responded they'd be under $1 million, 1 to 5, 29%, 6 to 10 million, 5%, over 10 million, 4%, unknown, 40%.
Okay, well, the unknown, it disappoints me when the league is questioned. I've seen a number of questionnaires asking their opinion, and they have this high non-response, which I think is regrettable, and I hope if somebody from LOC is hearing that they'll taking it to heart. But at more than $1 million, you've eliminated a quarter. And Mr. Bond says that it might be higher. I'm curious how that number gets set. And I'm sorry that LOC is not more fully participatory.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we're still in negotiations with the providers. And part of that, the small balances, drives cost. And so we're trying to minimize cost. Okay. And another issue is if a local government has less than $1 million, odds are they shouldn't be playing in this pool. They probably are not of a level of sophistication that they understand the risks, and this may well not be the kind of instrument. They still have the short-term fund. We always have that available. The short-term fund, there's not right now, there's not tremendous difference in rates. It varies over time. And we'll do whatever we reasonably can, but we really want to make sure that we're trying to have as an effective cost structure as we can for all of
you've made your case for me. Thank you.
The program rules. Deposits and withdrawals of participant funds to and from the fund will be processed at month end using close of day pricing and provided on the first business day of the following month. And requests for deposits or withdrawals must be received at least 10 business days prior to month end. In other words, once a month, 10-day notice. Administration, we anticipate there will be an online portal for participants, accounting management handled by State Street, a call center to answer questions, and we think this is an important component of the program to make sure that we're providing an adequate level of service. I'd like to also add that Treasury will be handling applications and determining eligibility, as I noted earlier, and that Treasury will also be handling some of the compliance, and that refers back to Mr. Shervin's presentation on Aladdin and the capabilities that we have through that program. And last, expected fees. So fees will vary based on total assets under management. Additional fees will be based on number of calls, frequency of statements, number of deposits and withdrawals. The numbers I provided to you are all in. So this will be the total amount, and they may fluctuate. So a participant that just parks the money and then doesn't have a lot of in and outs will not be charged as much. A participant that has a lot of ins and outs or will be charged a little bit more. Number of phone calls, that said, will kind of drive, will change costs. So what we're looking at is for $100 million in assets under management, 26 basis points. And then for $150 million in assets under management, we're looking at 17 basis points. So as you can see, we were able to drive down the cost for participants by providing a larger, having more participation.
And really quick, I believe in a conversation we had that there's going to be some seed money put in to get the program
off
the ground.
We're looking at that as an option. That's one of the things that we're going to have conversations with the council with, is whether or not that makes sense, because clearly driving to these numbers, I think if we drive to 200 million, I think it drops to 2.15%. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see what we can do to be able to push those costs down.
Perfect. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Several quick questions. Was State Street selected by competitive bidding?
Mr. Chair, okay. Senator Whitson, no. We negotiated directly with them. They're our custodian bank, and it was the quickest way to bring
the,
it up.
And then do you believe that that State Street will be able to provide a better return on investment than Oregon State Treasurer, Oregon Investment Council? And do you believe that they will be able to charge an equal or lesser fee than you would be able to, or their OIC would be able to? And will the State Street provide equal or better portfolio liquidity than you would be able to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, I think the answer to all of those questions is yes.
Thank you.
So,
perfect. All righty. We have 1 minute. Any closing? You're good. All right. Colleagues, any other questions for our panel? Thank you very much. Really appreciate you coming up and sharing this information.
Thank you.
John.
LFO was pleased to see some more detailed information in the agency's presentation than was in. Them contained in their report, but LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Mr. Okay. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I would move the LFO recommendation.
Perfect. So Senator Johnson moves the LFO recommendation to acknowledge receipt of the report. And I want to thank the Treasurer's Office for getting this information to us. It's really, really important that we work together. John is, you know, the knowledge base that we rely on, and so the more you can work with John, the better. All right. Any Representative Nathanson.
A quick comment, just to say we've all been pleased to track progress with working to finally get to an implementation that we've been waiting for a while. This is going to be well received. It's important. Keep on doing it, because we're waiting for the planning to end and the work to begin.
Thank you. Colleagues, is there any opposition to acknowledging receipt of the report? Seeing none before us, we're acknowledging receipt of the report. Do I have someone who wants to carry this in full Ways and Means?
I can.
Representative Nathanson.
Unless the senator would like to.
Go ahead. That was your baby.
Representative Nathanson, would you carry this in full Ways and Means? Appreciate it. All righty. I don't think I have any more work on this, so I'm going to close this work session. We're going to close the work session on the local government intermediate term investment pool report. Thank you. And we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4131.
Mr. Chair, while the new team is coming up, could I be recorded as voting in the affirmative on House Bill 4135?
I'm glad you raised that. We also had Representative Frederick.
It was my fault. He was stuck in the hall.
All right. So, colleagues, we have a motion to have Senator Johnson and Representative Frederick vote on House Bill 4135. Is there any opposition to this? Seeing none, Senator, Representative, how do you vote?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Senator Johnson is an aye. Representative Frederick is an aye. Julie, are we good with that? Okay. All righty. So I'm opening up the public hearing on House Bill 4131. Representative, it's good to have you in front of us.
Hello, hello. Chair Smith, members of the committee, so nice to see everyone. And Representative Frederick, you're sitting in my former seat.
Oh, okay.
So, for the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative, House District 41. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 4131A. This bill gives the Department of Revenue two meaningful tools to improve debt collection for the state of Oregon. My Senate co-chief sponsor for this bill is Senator Betsy Johnson, and I thank her for her support. House Bill 4131 is also supported by the Governor's Office, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice, the Speaker's Office, and the credit unions, and is based on recommendations from the 2015 Secretary of State's debt collection audit. Before I continue with the bill, I'm going to give some important background on how the bill came to be. According to the 2015 Secretary of State's debt collection audit, liquidated and delinquent debt owed to the state has nearly doubled since 2008 to $3.2 billion, of which the Department of Revenue is responsible for collecting nearly $1 billion of that, mostly general fund dollars. Collection rates over that time period have dropped. During the 2015 legislative session, we took steps to address our state's debt collection problems by passing Senate Bill 55. Senate Bill 55, which of course came through this subcommittee, is a bill I championed with others, including Senator Whitsitt, to improve collection efforts by creating a centralized debt collection oversight division within the Department of Administrative Services, and also took the first steps towards starting a vendor offset program. The Secretary of State's audit contained additional recommendations which were not included in Senate Bill 55. Jamie Rawls from the Secretary of State's Audits Division is here to speak more in detail about the audit. House Bill 4131A contains two additional recommendations from the audit to improve state debt collection. These two tools include accessing the data in the new higher report sooner and utilizing financial institution data matching to more efficiently issue bank levies or garnishment on debtor accounts. Where state law permits, these tools are being used. In addition, the Department of Justice Division of Child Support uses these methods in a similar way to collect unpaid child support payments. Currently, employers are required to submit relevant information of new and rehired employees to state child support collectors within days of the hiring date. However, the Department of Revenue must rely on the Employment Department to share their quarterly employer data, which is not reported for nearly 6 months after the hiring date. The audit recommends that Department of Revenue also be given access to the information in the new hire report at the same time in order to assist with wage garnishment and locate wage earners who are not paying taxes or fines owed to the state of Oregon or local jurisdictions. House Bill 4131A allows the Department of Revenue to have this useful information sooner, which would make their collection efforts more efficient and effective. House Bill 4131A also requires financial institutions to do data matches with the Department of Revenue. Data matching is known to be an effective tool to determine where a debtor account is located. Currently, in order for the Department of Revenue to find out where an account is held, the department has to request that information from each bank individually. Obviously, this is very inefficient, and each request costs the Department of Revenue approximately $10 per debtor. By utilizing broader data matching between the Department of Revenue and the financial institutions, the department will be able to efficiently locate debtor accounts, issue garnishments, and improve collection rates on delinquent debt, returning much-needed funds to our state. This is a general overview of what the bill does, and I'm going to turn it over now to Jamie Rawls from the Secretary of State, and then Deanna Mack from the Department of Revenue. We also have the Assistant Attorney General here, if you'd like to hear from him, Michael Ritchie, and he can talk more about the child support and data matching. And then Elsie, of course, is here to answer questions. We also worked with the credit unions on this bill in crafting the amendments to ensure all functions on their end. And we've also worked with the Bankers Association, and we've made the vast majority of the changes that they have requested. In closing, I ask that you support House Bill 4131A and adopt the Dash 7 amendment. And I also want to thank, again, the co-chairs and the members of the committee for considering House Bill 4131A, and I hope that you pass it out today. But I do, before we go on, I do really want to thank the credit unions in particular. They've been very supportive. Pam Levitt has a letter of support on OLIS, if you'd care to look at that. And turn over to Jamie.
So really quick, Representative, could you just take 20 seconds and talk about the Dash 7 amendments?
Yes. So the Dash 7 amendment, actually, I will turn it over to there's some very specific things in here, and I don't want to I understand them, but we've had a lot of back and forth, and she will cover them. Would you like her to do that now?
It's your panel. How do you want to do
this? Yes, go ahead. Go ahead. You can say that real quickly if you want to make certain that.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and the A7 amendment, the match for the financial institution data match is supposed to be done on a quarterly basis, and the original bill was written at least quarterly, which implied that it should be more frequently than that, and so it's not more than is one of the changes in there. There was a grammatical change in line 22, changing which to that in line in page 2. After the words institution or the financial institution is not required to seek any additional information. So if we give them the tax ID number and the name, they don't have to go looking for additional information to verify that that person is the correct person. If they can't make a match right out of the gates with the information we give them, that's making it very clear that that's the change. And then in line 35, after institution, they're deleting the rest of the language. The language that they want, that the banks asked for, was to remove us sending them sending us the bank account balances. So they just give us a thumbs up or down. Yes, there's an account here. No, there's not an account here. They don't have to tell us the balance in the account. And so those are conforming amendments in the A7.
Got it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Johnson, then we're going to come to you. I promise we're going to get to you.
One of the issues that's been raised is what the banks would discover in doing the due diligence. And what I think you just said is that there is no reporting of balances. It's just, yes, Betsy Johnson has an account at XYZ Bank, or no, she does not, without saying anything about the account.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, that's correct. In the with the A7 amendments.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Jamie Rawls. I'm a principal auditor at the Secretary of State Audits Division, and I was the in-charge auditor on the debt collections audit that was released this last September. So for today's presentation, I plan on just giving a brief background specific to the two tools that we had discussed in the audit that's being recommended in the bill, and then opening it up for questions. The objective of our audit was to determine if Oregon can improve collection of liquidated and delinquent debt. Specifically, we wanted to know if promising practices in Oregon or other states could be replicated to improve collections. The impetus for the audit was a 5-year trend of increasing delinquent debt, declining collection rates, and the lack of a statewide leadership overseeing the collections of delinquent debt. To determine the best practices, we interviewed officials from the U.S. Department of Treasury and 15 states that were focused on collection best practices. From those interviews, we quickly identified 5 best practice themes and narrowed our focus on to 6 states that made improving collections a sustained priority and had similar demographics to Oregon and, like Oregon, had a state income tax. The 6 states were Colorado, Kentucky, Maryland, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Through our research, discussion with other states, and interviews with Oregon officials, we found tools Oregon could pursue to increase collections. 2 of those tools that we listed in the audit report were bank account levies, referred to as bank matching, and access to the DOJ new hire report. So quickly, the new hire report was just basically, under federal child support law, employers are required to submit lists of new employees within roughly 20 days of hire. And that's used by child support collectors. The Employment Department also receives quarterly employment data on employees and wages, but that's 3 to 6 months after the hiring date. We found only three collection units had access to the more timely information, which was DOJ Child Support Unit, the Employment Department, and the Office of Payment and Recovery, which is a shared service of DHS and OHA. DOR had mentioned in the interviews they would like to receive access to the new hire report and believe it would improve their ability to garnish wages and identify wage earners who had not filed taxes. DOR's research had indicated that eight state taxing authorities had access to the new hire information, and those states included California and North Carolina, who appear to be in a similar legal position to Oregon, the department had concluded at the time. DOR first identified the issue in 2012 and had planned to seek legislation authorizing its access to the report in the 2015 legislative session. However, as of August 2015, when we were conducting the audit, we had learned that DOJ officials had not responded to DOR's request for legal clarity. So we first recommended expanded access to this back in our 1997 audit. As speed is critical in collections, access to the new hire could allow agencies to garnish wages they may not have known about. It could also let collectors know the debtor location. For the bank data matching, when it comes to bank garnishment and levies, we found that all but one of Oregon's largest debtor agencies have to guess where a debtor might be banking. Other states, including Wisconsin and California, have worked with financial institutions to implement broader statewide matching systems that allow them to quickly link debtors to the matching bank accounts. In Oregon, we learned the only agency that can match that debtors to bank account balances for the collection is the Department of Justice Child Support Program. Federal law requires all states to access bank information for child support debt. Other Oregon agencies have to send requests to banks where they believe a debtor has money. If there is a match and required authorizations are in place, the bank takes the money from the debtor account and sends it to the agency. Sometimes collectors have a canceled check or other clues that allow them to see where a debtor banks, but if not, they have to guess, typically based on the last known address. The lack of information deters filing bank account levy requests, which carry fees. Other states, we found, had created bank account matching systems that go beyond child support. The systems allow them to send levy requests to banks with much more confidence that debtor money is actually there. From our interviews with Wisconsin, we learned its statewide system includes data from about 500 banks operating in the state, and the state law requires the banks to participate.
Wisconsin. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Is there any cutoff on how big the bank is in that Wisconsin example? They're required to participate. Do they exclude little bitty community banks? Or
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, we didn't look into that, okay, that detail, but Deanna might be able to answer that.
Little bitty is a technical banking term.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I don't know the answer to the specific question about, I believe you said Wisconsin.
Right,
what
Wisconsin.
But this bill actually allows for us to determine whether it's cost effective for financial institutions to participate or not.
Thank you.
We can exempt them from that if they're in hardship or financial hardship or if it's not cost effective.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. First, cost effective is probably in the eyes of the beholder. But my question is, under what authority does the state of Oregon tell a bank like Wells Fargo or Chase to garnish an account that's held in another state?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, right now the bill does not allow, right now, current law, and I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to try and give you legal advice on this, but my understanding is that Chapter 18 allows us to garnish bank account information. But some banks, even though the debtor is operating in Oregon and the bank is operating in Oregon, simply because the bank account was opened in another state, they will tell us that they have no account found in Oregon, even though the debtor is operating here. And so one of the components of the bill that we're trying to clarify is that even if the account was opened in another state, that we're asking for clarity to say it doesn't really matter if they opened it in Vancouver. If they're doing business, if they're here in Oregon, the bank is operating in Oregon, and we send them a garnishment, that we want them to not tell us that there's no account found, but instead respond with some, you know, there's an account here, there's no balance, or the funds are exempt, or here's the amount of money in the account. But that is one of the provisions in the bill that they're trying to, the DOJ, as far as I know, is trying to correct.
So to be clear,
please follow
to your testimony, is that this bill would not provide authority, you know, the requirement for a bank to garnish funds held in a bank in a different state?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, my understanding of this bill would be, and maybe there's Elsie or someone can help who is an attorney, is that when the debtor is in Oregon, if the debtor is outside of Oregon, we have to transcribe the judgment to that state, and then we can issue a garnishment through the court system through that state, just like we can, like any other debtor can, through a writ of garnishment and garnish the assets that way. If the debtor is out of state, if the debtor is not operating in Oregon. If the debtor is operating in Oregon, the debtor, we have jurisdiction over their person. We are allowed to issue the garnishment to the financial institution. And some of them, even though they may be operating in Oregon, they may have also have an operation in Washington that's the same, you know, the same, everyone by name knows it as, you know, whatever XYZ bank, as Senator Johnson used as an example earlier, everyone knows it by name, but because technically they opened it in, you know, online in another state, perhaps we are getting responses saying, no, there's no account found here, even though we have, you know, the direct deposit information shows that they have an account.
Yeah, I get that. I just wanted to make sure that that it's your testimony that you were not suggesting that an interstate, you know, bank that has locations in more than one state is required to garnish you that. I don't think we have authority to do that. The other question I have is about the account disclosure. And it seems like it puts the, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but if I'm reading it correctly, the bank is not allowed to use the information that they garner from this exercise in determining loan eligibility or, you know, any eligibility for their potential client. And how do they determine whether they learned it in this process or they already knew it? And how do they defend themselves in court if somebody says, you learned it here when they already knew it, if you follow what I'm saying?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, so you're talking about in Section 4 of the Engross bill, where it says nothing prohibits them from sharing that they participate in the data match, and then the later on where it says that the only purpose for the information that we give them, the Social Security number and the so the Social Security number and the name of the debtor is the information that we would be giving them, and so they are not allowed to use it for any other purpose other than. So basically a list of debtors is what the banks would get, and they're not allowed to use that information to for any other purpose than helping us with collection of the debt. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that they would not be able to use that list of debtors to say this person is a debtor and I should not lend to them because they owe a tax debt. They can get that information from publicly recorded sources.
And the point being, when a smart attorney comes up to them and says, where did you learn it? Did you learn it in this process where you can't use it, or did you learn it over here in a process which you can use?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I would expect that they have the recorded deed or the recorded document from the county records.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Representative, do you have one last closing comment?
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. If you, Deanna was going to walk through the bill, if you'd like to hear that, I don't know how time is. She's going to tell you what the bill does in more detail than what I did. If you wanted to hear that,
I think we have the bill in front of us. I think we've all had a chance to read it. I think
we're good. Okay,
all right. You. All right. So, Gary, come on down. And Tim and Ken, come on down.
Okay.
Everybody be nice to Gary. He's one of my neighbors in Heppner. That's an amazing family. Amazing family.
I'm used to three people testifying at once.
Oh, well. And so here's what I'm going to ask. If, in the interest of time, if each of you could keep it to 3-4 minutes each, right in there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Oregon Community Banks of Oregon. I'm joined by on my immediate right by Gary Profiter, your neighbor, mm-hmm. who happens to be an executive vice president with the Bank of Eastern Oregon over in Heppner. And to his right is Ken Sherman, longtime counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, who has written and rewritten garnishment manual for banks longer than, I won't say longer than I've been alive because I've been a long, long time, but a long time he's written those things. So he's really an expert on garnishment. I would just begin by saying thanking Representative Taylor for working with us on this bill. She has been very helpful, and I think if you compare the original bill to the A and Gross, there's some major changes in it, which we appreciate. There still are some things that we are very problematic about. Senator Whitsitt raised a couple of them. And I want you also to know that while this issue has been around since about 2009, and states have looked at it, it's my understanding that nationally only about 11 states have actually implemented this. There are states that are looking at this session, some of which are voluntary, but there's only, as far as I know, about 11 states in the country that have done this. We committed last year to work with the Department of Revenue for a bill in 2017. We were actually quite surprised when the bill was introduced, although, again, the representative has worked with us literally daily to try to make the bill in an acceptable form. You've heard conversation about child support, and this, you know, you're doing it for child support. There's no difference. In one of our early calls, we suggested to the Department of Justice, let's just combine this into one section of the statute. Let's make child support and this the same. I'll let them speak for themselves, but what I heard on the phone was a clear no, we don't want to do that. We want to keep them separate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
That begs the question, why? Are they going to testify? Mr. Chair?
If you'd like, once they're done, we'll...
I'd like to know why.
Yeah, we'll have them come back up.
And before I turn it over to Ken, because I know you're short on time, you have our Dash 8 amendments. They deal with the ability to use the information, which is what California does allow in its current law. The Secretary of State, I think, or her office, testified that California law is a great example. So we agree with that. We think that's something that ought to be included, and that's a simple change of deleting the word use.
Have you taken your Dash 8s to the co-chairs for consideration on that? Have you talked to Chair Buckley and Chair
I have not.
Devlin?
I have not. I will, that's next on my list. I was talking to members, but I will certainly do that. So we agree with Alan, Secretary of State. Also, and this is kind of a minor deal because I don't want you to think this is a way for us to make money. The Representative Taylor has been very clear that we're just kind of a intermediary, and financial institutions should not suffer and should not incur costs as a result of setting up this new program. And there is some funding in there to set up the program. And then after that, it's $150 per quarter per bank, whether it's Bank of Eastern Oregon, whether it's you name a bank, Umpqua Bank, and on upsize. It's that's how much they have in the bill. California, again, good bill. $250. That's in our amendment. So our amendments are not very detailed. We think they do no harm to the bill. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Sherman to talk briefly and I think maybe answer your garnishment question, Senator Whitsitt.
Well, thank you very much. I am Ken Sherman. I'm counsel to the Oregon Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to share some concerns about this bill. First of all, I think Tim has made it clear that we do support the concept of this bill. It's just two or three remaining issues that we're concerned about. The one I want to focus on is in Section 12, which is the amendment to the garnishment law. All of the rest of this bill has nothing to do with garnishment. It has to do with establishing a data match program, which is just gathering information, and we understand that. But Section 12 actually amends the garnishment law. The garnishment law today says that when you garnish a bank, the garnishment reaches all of the funds in all accounts within the state. It says that because you have really serious due process and full faith and credit problems when you start trying to do what we think this bill is intended or attempting to do, which is to reach across state lines and to garnish a bank account in Washington or Virginia or wherever it may be. We now have nationwide banks. So I'm a resident of the state of Virginia, and I have a bank account at U.S. Bank has branches in both Oregon and Virginia. If this becomes law, if it means what we think it is intended to mean, and the meaning is not clear, then a DOR or any other garnishee, any other creditor, this isn't limited to the Department of Revenue. This applies to everybody who gets a judgment in a private lawsuit. Any garnishee can reach clear back to Virginia, and without any opportunity for me, the resident of Virginia, to have due process of law, that money simply disappears out of my account. That is not consumer friendly. That is a terrible precedent for this state, which has been very much in the forefront and leading on consumer protection, to make. Let's say that Virginia has a, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and Virginia, I think, actually has some laws to grant special protection. Let's say that they have a law that says Vietnam veterans, the first $5,000 in your account is not subject to garnishment. Well, if this becomes law, that garnishment pays no attention to the protection that the state of Virginia has tried to give me by passing that law. I think that's a horrible precedent for us to set. Another problem we have with this particular section is that it, unlike the rest of the bill, has 15 months before it becomes effective. This section would become effective when governor puts pen to paper. It becomes effective immediately and applies statewide, worldwide, to all garnishments that are issued by the state of Oregon or any agency of the state of Oregon. We need some time, if this horrible thing is going to be done, to be able to gear up to that. We can't do that kind of change in our systems just overnight. So we've got a real serious problem with that. On the other issue that really gets me going is the use information. And I want to give you an example. I'm sitting in my bank. I get the DOR list that I'm supposed to match to, and I see Joe Blow on there. I happen to know that we're in the process of looking at a loan application from Joe Blow. Joe Blow's application says he's debt-free. He doesn't owe anything to anybody. But DOR just told me through the list that Joe lied on his loan application and is, in fact, owes some money, we don't know how much, to the Department of Revenue or somebody else that you're collecting for. What am I supposed to do with that information? Ignore it to my own detriment? That just doesn't make sense. And so that's the concern that we have with that section. And with that,
Representative Hurd, you had a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is it at all possible that we can get clarification from LC? I think that was what Senator Whitsett was referencing earlier when the other panel was up, was do we even have that authority to do that? It seems strange to me that we actually would have that authority to do that, because if Virginia, in this example, has certain laws saying other states, you can't do that unless the federal government tells us you are allowed to do that, I don't see how a law we pass here in our state could force another state's laws out of the way. Is there any way we can get...
You have every ability to go talk to legislative council and to get that taken care of and ask the question.
Well, with that, I'll stop and let Gary, your neighbor,
my neighbor,
have his 2 cents worth. Thank you very much for your attention, and I appreciate the attention. Thanks.
Hey, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this. My associate here has been so eloquent in describing the issues, it sort of leaves me nothing left to say. We are a small bank with 12 branches in Oregon and one branch in Washington. So this garnishment issue truly affects us right across the border in Pasco. How do we deal with a situation where we have a garnishment presented to us in Heppner and we have to respond to it's for a customer in Pasco who's a Washington resident? We're left in the air. We don't want to violate Washington law. We don't want to violate the rights of that consumer while we're trying to fulfill our obligations to Oregon.
Hey, Gary, really quick for the record, can you share your full name?
Yes, my name is Gary Profiter, EVP and Chief Operations Officer for Bank of Eastern Oregon. My apologies, Chair.
Perfect. Nope,
Chair.
You're good.
Co-Chair Smith, if I could take his last minute since you didn't use it, if I may. We would pledge to the proponents, to this subcommittee, garnishment law is very complex. We would pledge to try and get the Chair of the House Judiciary and the Senate Judiciary Committee to put this on their work list for the interim for 2017. Because as you can hear, I think you understand, we're very passionate that this change may not be fully understood, even by us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. All right. I have Mike Ritchie. Do you want to come up really quick? I'm genuinely not trying to be rude, but I'm only going to give you about 3 minutes.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I work as the general counsel for the child support program. Ideally, there would have been an assistant attorney general who works at the Department of Revenue here today, but he was in a mediation in Portland, so I'll do my best to answer questions. I'm going to keep my remarks to the three issues that I think have been raised in terms of questions. The first was from Senator Johnson, wanted to know why it wasn't possible to simply merge the two data match systems. Child support's data match system is a specific creature of federal law. We were mandated in accordance with federal law, and that federal law carried with it authority for the employers or for the financial institutions to report. It's a broader law. It has a significantly broader definition of financial institution. It has a broader definition of account. And it also requires the return of information about account balances so that a cost-benefit analysis can be made to determine whether it's worth the effort to issue a writ. So for those reasons, it was, in the first place, I don't think that the authority in the federal law would have extended to a non-child support use. But in addition, the needs of the child support program went beyond what I think the banks are prepared to accept.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Does the federal child support speak to this question of garnishment that the bank testimony just raised?
It does not, but Oregon law does.
Okay.
The specific statute that we're talking about in Section 12 is 18655, and it says, it's in a series of statutes that says how you serve writs for a variety of garnishees, recipients of writs. And when it's financial institution, it says that you can send it to any branch in the state or to an address designated by the financial institution. It also says if it's delivered in accordance with that statute, that it serves to garnish any property that's within the possession, control, or custody at any branch that is being held in Oregon. It doesn't say property that's located in Oregon. It says it's being held. And it's our position at the Department of Justice that that existing law permits us to issue a writ to an obligor who incurred a debt in Oregon to a branch that exists in Oregon and is subject to service of process in Oregon, and it would encumber an account that happened to be issued in another state. In a very real sense, in the era of modern banking, money in an account is not held in any state, and it's held in every state at the same time. There's not a safe somewhere with a bag of money that has the obligor's name on it or that has the debtor's name on it. That money is placed into the interstate banking system. And I can open an account in Oregon, go to vacation in Nevada, take out money and go gamble, and then go to California. If I happen to win, I can deposit my winnings back into my same account in California. If I lose, I can get more money to go spend on the rest of my vacation in a very real sense.
So, Mr. Ritchie, I'm gonna ask you to wrap it up. Do you have just one final thought you want to leave with us?
The final thought is that there's an existing Supreme Court case. It's called Controlled Data. In that case, an Oregon debtor incurred a debt here, went to work for an employer in Minnesota. While he was in Minnesota, Oregon garnished his account garnished that employer in Oregon for wages that weren't in Minnesota, and the Oregon Supreme Court said that Oregon had the authority to garnish that property for wages that weren't wholly in Minnesota. And the reason it did is because the employer was subject to process in Oregon and the debt was incurred here, so the judgment was created when there was personal jurisdiction over the debtor. And it's those two things that are the linchpin.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Sorry. So that you just have rebutted the argument that was raised by Chair Smith's neighbors.
I have expressed the Department of Justice's position on this issue.
Very diplomatic. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Pam, you want to come share?
2 minutes.
90 seconds.
Sure.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, Pam Levitt representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. We're here in support of House Bill 4131A with the Dash 7 amendment. I just received the Dash 8 amendment and have sent it off to our legislative committee to review, so we'll certainly take a look at that. Our members have been working on the Child Support Data Match Program through the Department of Justice since the 1990s. When we reviewed this bill with them, our attorney, our legislative committee, had several recommendations that we worked with Representative Taylor on related to vendors, compensation to the program, security issues, protection of member information, and all of those issues were worked out and are already included in House Bill 4131A. So I just want to let you know that we are currently supporting the bill and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you. So, colleagues, just really quick, the data match system, while the bill talks about the emergency clause, the data match system will not become effective until July 1st, 2017. And so we want to get back. All right, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Last chance. All right. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4131. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 4131.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash A7 amendment to House Bill 4131.
Okay. Madam Co-Chair moves the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 4131. Is there any comments on these amendments? Is there any opposition to these amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4131 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as modified by the Dash A7 amendment.
Madam Co-Chair moves House Bill 4131 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
To the full committee.
To the full committee on the full committee, the full joint committee on ways and means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this. Opposition or comments first.
Yeah, I'd like to support this bill. I'm supporting the bill today until I learn a little more about the legal ramifications. That is very disturbing to me.
Perfect. All right. Representative Hurd.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm of a similar mindset. I was not able to get the answer to my question, or rather our mutual question. The drafter is not available at the moment, but so I'll be a no at the moment, but that could change once I get clarification.
And I'll share with the committee, I'm going to be a yes vote. The reason for my yes vote is I've had an opportunity to work with the representative on this piece of legislation. I have not heard from the opposition on this bill until Friday at 10 in the morning, and in my view, that's unacceptable, and so I'll be a yes vote coming out of committee. All right, so we've got a motion before us. We've got no's from Senator Whitsitt and Representative Hurd. Is there any other opposition? Seeing none, the bill is passed. I need a carrier to the full committee on ways and means.
Chief Sponsor.
Senator, you're on the bill. Senator Whitsitt's like, I'll carry it. All right, so Senator Johnson, and then we need him to the floor. Representative Taylor, House floor, obviously. Senate floor, do you have preference?
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Senator Johnson. All right. John, have we covered everything?
Yes, I would just, if I may, Mr. Kochar, I'd just note that we have a draft fiscal impact out there. There's no fiscal impact for the current biennium, but there is a general fund fiscal impact for next biennium. There's also a revenue impact in process. The same thing with the revenue impact. No revenue impact is anticipated for 15-17, but for 17-19.
Sir, one of these times I'm going to learn not to get out front of you before I take the motions.
So, thank you.
One of these days.
You learn, then I'm going to have to learn. I'm never going to learn that.
Colleagues, is there anything before us that we need to talk about? Be prepared for Wednesday, Senator Whitsitt. The piece of legislation you and I have been discussing is scheduled for a public hearing, and so we'll have that. Colleagues, I apologize that we're running 7 minutes over schedule, but we did get the business done. We had to get done today. Julie, is there anything we need to think about? We're good? All right. We're going to adjourn. Adjourn. Good. All right. We're going to.